Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Our next show, the next one on the roster, the next broadcast you hear is going to be show number 400. We launched in June of 2010, and here we are all these years later, and we're still kicking. And I'm so grateful to you for listening and supporting the show and getting us here. So there won't be a broadcast next week. I am going to release, I think, a short form video, but I'm going to take the week, and then the first Tuesday in September will be our 400th broadcast. And if you have something you'd like to say or contribute for that show, you are more than welcome to submit something to podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. The show today is a conversation between myself and a guy named Gregory. Gregory had sent me an email message, and he was talking about how he was navigating out of some very religious waters, and he was having some trouble taking the final steps. And so as I was sort of perusing his message, I thought this might be a conversation worth having. I mean, you know, as we approach show number 400, if there's any one mission this show has, it's to help people. I want it to be entertaining and informative and compelling, but most of all, I want it to be helpful. I want it to provide benefit to someone's life. I want to make a difference out there. What better example of that than to have a one-on-one exchange with somebody who really was asking for help? And I asked Gregory if he might be open to having this conversation on the radio, and he was all for it. He thought it was a great idea for that very reason. There might be somebody else listening who might benefit from our discussion. And so that's what this show is going to be here in just a second. I will speak to Gregory about his journey out of religion and the final obstacle or obstacles that remain. And as you probably already determined from the title of the broadcast, one of those obstacles is the fear of hell. Anyway, that's coming up in just a second. Before we get into that conversation, I want to say thanks to the sponsor of today's show. In my house, my friends, I don't exaggerate when I tell you that HelloFresh has changed how we cook. It's changed what we eat, how we spend our time. And probably most interestingly, it's brought back the enjoyment of being in the kitchen. You know, you're not rushing through the rut of old recipes or just scrambling for ingredients at the store. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service. It essentially does the shopping, the planning, and the delivery for you, with easy recipes and pre-measured ingredients shipped right to your door. Choose from 3 different meal plans. They have the classic, they have the veggie, and the family every week has a 20-minute meal on the classic menu for those days when you're really in a rush. The pre-measured ingredients eliminate food waste, which is awesome. The food itself is delicious. It's so good. They've got the crispy cheddar Frico cheeseburger. You oven bake the cheese. It is my favorite burger ever. The lobster ravioli is amazing. Last week's HelloFresh included sesame beef tacos. That's a quick 20 minutes in the kitchen. We devoured them. They were delicious. It's simple. It's manageable. It's fun. Wonderful new recipes that get you out of the recipe rut. And the packaging is even recyclable. And for a total of $60 off, that's $20 off your first 3 boxes, just go to HelloFresh.com/SethAndrews60 and enter Seth Andrews 60, that's 60, for your $60 off. Try them for yourself. You're going to love them. $60 off at HelloFresh.com/SethAndrews60 with the same promo code SethAndrews60. I've got Gregory on the line. Gregory, are you with me, my friend?
Yes, I'm with you. Thank you for having me.
Gregory, are you a Christian?
I want to be honest with you. I don't know.
Were you a Christian? Yes. Have you been in the past a Christian?
Yes, devoted Christian.
All right, so how did you get to a point now where you're on the bubble and looking around wondering whether you are a Christian?
Honestly, there's a very, I should say, misrepresented verse in Scripture that says, "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." And I started seeking out for that truth. I had my degree in information technology, but I wanted to do my master's on theology. And inside that, the field of apologetics. Unfortunately, as I was starting, I started browsing the net for articles, books, from people who have been doing this for a long time. And I have noticed that every single article, debate, even podcast, you name it, that has an apologist and a scientist, or any atheist, or somebody that works with education, the only thing that I can remember that the apologists are coming with are like Bible verses, and I'm sorry to say, misrepresented science. Regarding what science says, the Bible says otherwise. And I didn't want to go that way. If I believe in a God that made everything and created everything, I really wanted something that I could grasp, something that, I don't know, holds water. I haven't been able to find anything. That kind of started to dig a hole in me, started to
Yeah, sure. The dominoes start to fall, right?
Exactly, exactly. And the point is that now I have a conflict between what I've been doing for years. I accepted Jesus at 18, and I'm 42 now, so you can tell. So I feel pretty much like Matt DeLahunty at this point. What I was doing for years, what I was believing for years, and even teaching for years, I am faced with a giant that I can't go around.
All right, well, let me ask you a few questions, and you decide how much you want to respond. But tell me about your upbringing and conversion experience. Mom and Dad were believers?
My dad was. My mom sort of was, but she, you know, since I come from a home in which, you know, we do what daddy says, so pretty much we all went to church when I was a child, yeah.
How did you end up saying the salvation prayer? Paint that picture for me.
It was in the church, and my parents were having a struggle at that time, and I think shortly afterwards they broke up. And I was going to this church, and I was feeling accepted in this church. One day I decided to accept Jesus, you know, the usual stuff.
What was the catalyst that caused you to accept Jesus at that moment? Were you unhappy? Was it a charismatic preacher that convinced you in the moment? Was it something else?
Honestly, I can't recall. You know, it's been a while.
Okay, well, I mean, that's fair. But understanding why we do things often helps us to understand the effect that they have on us, you know?
That's the thing. You just said it yourself. Understanding why we do things. Within those walls, the church walls, I mean, I don't think anyone understands. You're asked to believe everything in faith, even if it makes no sense at all.
If I may, you sound rattled. I mean, I get that, right? Your whole world is sort of shifting and perceptions are changing. Do you have a fear of hell? Why does this bother you so much, these questions and doubts?
I've been raised believing this for many years. And if your question is, do you fear of a hell? Honestly, I do. I mean, I can't lie to you. Honestly, I do. It's like something psychological inside. It's like something that is like wired on the back of your head, and you just can't seem to rub it off, unfortunately.
What if we were to look at it in terms of not hardware, but software? What if we were to look at the fear of hell being something that you were told when you were younger and that you believed when you were younger? It was a program sort of installed on the hard drive of your brain, okay? Is it possible then that the program might not be a good program to run and we could replace it with something better?
Definitely.
In that context, do you think that we might be able to not think of it as being hardwired, like I'm destined, I'm constructed this way, but instead I'm simply running a program that was installed in my psyche when I was younger, and there is an uninstall option? Do you think that's a possibility?
It may be. I mean, I can't say for certain yes or no. It might be. It might be like that. I hope it is like that. I hope it is.
Where does hell come from? Where did you get this notion of hell? And this is a leading question. I have my suspicions. I know where hell came from in my own upbringing because it was taught to us as literal fact, and you don't want to go there, do you? You tell me your story. How did this fear of hell get programmed onto your hard drive?
When I was a kid, I was about probably 8, 10. I had my first Bible. And some verses were highlighted because my father used it, and he wanted me to believe what he believed. But as a kid, he gave me that. And coming from my father's hands, I was like, all right, this is the right thing to read. And I started, obviously, with the highlighted verses. And then there is this whole passage in the book of Luke that has a parable regarding Lazarus and the rich man. I learned from those verses that there is a hell waiting for us if we don't do the master's biddings. And once you're there, that's it. That's the end of the line. For example, if you screw up on one job, what the heck? Go get another job. Or if you screw up or you bought the wrong house, okay, just sell them or do whatever and get another house. If you screw up in this life, as the Bible teaches, and you go to hell, that's it for eternity.
And you're 10 years old, right? You're approximately 10 years
old. I was about 8. Roughly 10. Yeah, I was a kid. Yeah.
Let's look at 8 years old. Okay, Gregory?
Yeah.
8 years old, right?
Yeah.
You're not even in junior high yet. How much did you really know about the world and how the world worked?
I think as far as I can go is my neighborhood at that particular point of time.
Right? You had a full-time guardian. You had people there to handle all the big questions. You know, you weren't even a teenager yet. You certainly weren't old enough to function as an adult would function. You can't vote. You can't drink. You can't drive. You can't serve in the military yet. You are very much an impressionable young person who was vulnerable to and susceptible to bad ideas. You are trusting in the guardian placed over you, right? Don't we often trust our parents when they tell us that this is true and this is not?
Yeah,
you trusted your father, right?
We do. We do. And I think I did the same with my daughters. And that's also something that's tearing me apart, you know?
We'll come back to that. I'm not discounting your current situation because I want to get there, but I want to do this in a more chronological way. Let's come back to you and your dad, okay?
Yeah.
You trusted your parent to give you good information, to keep you safe, and to know what was up, okay? So now we have to ask the question, is there a chance, looking back as a 42-year-old adult, is there a chance, a really good chance, that your father on this issue was very wrong? Yes or no?
There is, definitely, yes.
So if he's a human like we all are, and perhaps he had bad information, a bad program running on his hard drive, which he then transferred to you, is it possible that we are afraid of something that didn't exist in the first place? We're sort of blanching at a bad idea that we shouldn't have accepted to begin with. Is that a possibility?
It is a possibility indeed, yeah.
Your dad's not, he's not God. He's just a human being like the rest of us. We're all susceptible to bad ideas and bias and cultural influence and a lot of those types of factors, right?
That's correct, yeah.
I'm guessing he was motivated by love and wanting to do the right thing as a father. Would that be an overstatement?
I think that's exactly right. He was doing what he thought he was, you know, the right thing to do back in the day.
Have you looked at all into hell theology, like beyond the Bible? You know, how many religions have their paradise and pain? They have their reward and or punishment. Have you looked at the teachings about hell beyond the book of the Bible and where they might have come from and how the different manifestations of hell have been portrayed?
Yes, I have.
Okay. And what was that like for you? What'd you find?
I found something in common pretty much among every religion. A, you have a creation story. B, you have like a mission statement for human beings. You must do this. You must not do this. And pretty much everything involves the deity that created everything in the first place. And then looks like they all have some flavor of afterlife. You can become a god, like the Mormons think. Or you can be reigning on earth, the Jehovah's Witnesses. Or you can go to heaven, as the traditional Christians believe. Or you can have, for example, a whole bunch of women at your disposal, like religions from the Middle East. So basically, when I found that out, and I was like, wait a minute. It's like when you go to the mall, you have plenty of stores to choose from. How can I know if my God is the right one? And that started it all.
I like the analogy of going to order in a Mexican food restaurant. You know, if you go and you order a taco, what's in a taco? Well, there's a tortilla, meat, cheese, lettuce, tomato. Well, okay, I'd like a tostada. What's on that? Well, there's a tortilla, meat, cheese, lettuce, tomato. Okay. You know, what's in nachos? Well, there's a tortilla, meat, cheese, lettuce, tomato. Except they're arranged in different ways, right?
Yeah.
And religions like to do this. They prepare it in different ways and then they serve it up, but it's a lot of the same type of ingredients. Gregory, if I may, and forgive me, you sound like somebody who already knows it's all bullshit.
I'm almost at the other end, honestly.
You're at what, 97%? It's that final 3%. It's the final 1%. So what I'm sensing then, and the reason we're having this conversation, is there is a deep-seated part of you, if I may, an emotional part of you, that is terrified. If I get this wrong, I'm going to hell and I'll be tortured forever. And that 1% is keeping you up at night?
That is partially true. I mean, mostly true, honestly. What really, really, really bothers me is uncertainty, not knowing. For example, if you suffer from frequent headaches, for example, you're in the kitchen, you open up there, boom, and you have like 50 different medications. And they all have their labels in Greek, in Aramaic, in Spanish, in German, in Latin, but none of them has a label in English. And then, all right, you have to take one to deal with your problem, but make sure you don't get the wrong one, because it'll make it worse. I mean, I'm sorry for the sarcasm, you know. But it,
No, not at all. It's a great analogy, but let me back up, okay? If the physician really cared about you, if there was a benevolent physician who genuinely loved and cared for you and was worth, you know, you giving your time and attention and allegiance to, don't you think that physician would provide easy to understand instructions in a language that you speak? Don't you think that would be a reasonable expectation?
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. If the great physician genuinely loves me, why would he give me the remedy to my problem in a language that I can't comprehend? That would be kind of a sick joke, wouldn't it be?
Well, it is indeed, but it's accurate and straight to the point.
Yeah, but I'm saying, if you look at a deity from that perspective, we can then reject the idea of benevolence, of a God that genuinely cares enough, a personal God who would care enough to give us one-on-one, person-to-person, or God-to-person, rather, instructions.
Right.
Instead, we're looking at ancient texts in language, often dead languages, poorly interpreted languages, interpretations and translations conflicting with each other. It's a mess. There are thousands of different versions of Christianity alone. How many religions have existed in the history of all of humanity? And a worthy deity could part the curtain of the sky and solve it for everybody immediately. And yet, he's got you looking in the medicine cabinet at languages you don't understand. This actually helps us, doesn't it, to realize that the notion of a benevolent, loving, caring, involved God is not one rooted in reality. Does that make sense to you?
It makes perfect sense to me.
While I'm thinking about it, let's go back to the Bible. You said you were reading in the Bible, and this is where the seeds of your fear of hell sort of were planted, right? In the Bible?
Pretty much from the Bible, yeah.
Okay, from the Bible. So you're raised in a kind of fundamentalist Christianity. But if we look at the Adam and Eve story for the origin of humanity, and we look at that against the evidence in the human genome and all these other things, we know there's, not only is there no evidence to support it, but we know that Adam and Eve has been debunked. Would you agree that Adam and Eve, as the story for the origins of all of humanity, we can just put that one away because it has been refuted? Would you agree?
Well, yeah, my brain totally agrees.
Okay, well, that's where I want to camp out, right here on your brain. Okay, we'll come back to the heart in just a second. All right, you logically get it and say, we know the story of Noah, a 600-year-old guy who captained a floating zoo and the global flood. I mean, flood geology, all of that falls away under the overwhelming avalanche against the idea of Noah's Ark, right? And Noah, the story of Noah's flood. We can verify that it did not happen. Would you agree with that, or are you there yet?
It's not possible.
Okay. We're still in the book of Genesis chapter 6, but I mean, that's a foundational story of humanity and sort of God's reset on humanity. And if we go story by story through the Bible and the claims that the Bible makes as fact, that people in fundamentalist churches teach as fact, everything from 900-year-old humans to flying chariots of fire to talking animals to supermen who gain extra power based on the length of their hair and people who are cured from blindness thanks to magic muds and the idea of a supernatural Jesus who came to save the world and all of these types of things. If we realize that these are not rooted in reality and the Bible is wrong and then it's wrong again and it's wrong again and it's wrong again and it's wrong so many times, we can then say with extreme confidence that the Bible's claims about hell are also not rooted in reality. Does your logical brain go there with me?
Yes, my logical brain, yes.
Okay, so your logical brain already knows this is crap. This is a man-made construct largely designed to control people. And the best way, one of the best ways to control them is by keeping them afraid, keep them afraid to leave the tribe, to leave the temple, to leave the religion, to ask too many questions, certainly to doubt. Fear is a great mechanism for controlling people, and we understand that, right? You and I get how people can use fear. We see it in headlines all around the world, don't we?
Yeah, even the military uses it.
Yeah, it's a control mechanism, and it can be very, very effective. I don't have like a catch-all solution for this, but I understand the power of the emotional response whenever we walk away from our cherished faith. I mean, it speaks to comfort. It speaks to our fear of death or desire to live longer than we are going to live on this earth. It speaks to our desire to be reunited with loved ones in paradise someday. There's so many aspects to the heaven aspect of eternal life.
I would like to comment on that precisely. I don't know if you've heard a podcast from this. It's like Non Sequitur, I think it is. And this came in the debate with R. Ruff, with Kent Hovind. One of the moderators asked a very particular question. Let's say that the hell concept, it's taken out of the equation. There's no hell, right? Period. There's just no hell. Will you be a devoted Christian the same way if hell is taken out of the equation? And I heard that question. I'm like, well, you know what? I didn't realize how powerful the thought is.
Let me throw this caveat out. A lot of people attend church because it makes them feel good. Did you have an anticipation of heaven? And are you disappointed at the idea that you might not live forever in paradise?
I had it before. I don't want to sound like sarcastic.
Go ahead.
I had it before, but then I was like, all right, I died. Boom, I'm in heaven. Great. What now? What am I going to do here for eternity? My best friends are in hell, probably. So
I'm not laughing at you, Gregory. I'm sorry. Well, if you look at the Bible's version of heaven, it sounds pretty close to hell anyway. I mean, it's just 24/7. Well, actually, time doesn't exist, but it's an eternity of holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty who was and is to come. Essentially, you kiss Jesus' ass and Yahweh's ass forever. And And, you know, it just, it, to me, it's just doesn't sound appealing at all. And I know I'd done a video called Afterlife years ago where we talked about if everything is eternal, then things become meaningless because everything that can be accomplished will be accomplished. There's no urgency. I mean, you and I, Gregory, living a temporary life, knowing we're on the clock, knowing that the moments are precious and few, actually adds a sense of urgency to everything we are and do, right?
Yeah. That sort of makes the matter worse. I think not just for me, but for pretty much everybody else.
Well, why does it make it worse?
Because as a Christian, you live on a leash. So there's only so much you can do and so many places you can go. And the list of things you can do is about one page long, and the things that you can't do is like a phone book. You come to realize if you're like very devoted, hey, when I was young, I could have done this. I could have taken this decision, or I could have been going there or meeting this person that I didn't want to meet because he is not meeting the standards. You know, he is not a Christian. Or why didn't I marry this girl? Well, I was a Christian. She was not. And I let her go away.
Oh, I see. So you look back now as someone who sees
waste
the temporary nature of a finite life. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we can beat ourselves up over that one, man. I mean, I can, you know, sometimes I look at my 30 years in the faith and I think, oh God, you know, I'd have acted so much differently and done things so much differently. But there's a flip side to that, and that's that our time inside the faith has allowed us to see through the, actually, we've got an inside-out perspective, and we can use that to live a better informed life today. I mean, a lot of people live, you know, the first few chapters of their life with a lot of regret, and then they can use those experiences to really take their, forgive me, lemons and make lemonade. They can use the awfulness and the bad mistakes that they made in the past to build a better future. And I think don't beat yourself up over all the stuff that you missed out on. I think you're still a young man, Gregory. I mean, 42. You got me beat by 8 years, and and you got a lot of decades left. You know what I'm saying?
I may not reach you, man. Sorry about that. Sorry.
All right. Well, let's try to synopsize if we can. All right. Logically, we know that there's no reason to hold on to hell. You were a young child who was trusting, who was taught a Bible, taught to believe on faith, that you weren't properly exposed to ideas that criticized or even contradicted the Bible. You now can see the stories of the Bible as not being rooted in reality. And we can include hell theology in that long list of debunked stories. If you understand the mechanisms by which fear is used to control people, and you are also on a journey where you are accumulating information about things like evolution and cosmology and the human genome and rooting yourself in science and the scientific method and evidence-based thinking, it sounds like you already have all the tools you need. It sounds to me like you had the answer before we even started this conversation. You just don't want to admit it to yourself. And I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, right?
But it sounds to Gregory, you sound like somebody who knows it's all crap and you just need someone to help nudge you a little bit to encourage you to be able just to cut that final thread. Yes?
Yes. My deepest concern, for example, see, I have to work in my house in the roof. Do you know about the fear of heights?
I do indeed.
You probably fall from that height 8-10 feet, and I'm going to tell you. But you fear that fall in your life, and if there's something in your roof, you go ahead and pay somebody to take care of because you just won't go there.
And let me just stop you. Hang on. Our fear of heights is actually rooted in many ways in an evolved safety mechanism, which keeps us from harming ourselves. So when you're on the roof, you're actually being presented with the possibility of real physical danger. If you do slip and you fall over the side and you land on a concrete driveway or sidewalk, you could be seriously injured or killed. That's a legitimate threat. Where hell, that's a fabricated story. It's a fairy tale, a fantasy created that isn't tangible and doesn't present a real threat. Do you see the difference?
I do indeed, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, what I was trying to portray this, for example, maybe I chose the wrong sample. I apologize. So you are absolutely right. I apologize. I was wrong.
No. It's all good. You mentioned that you had some, I don't know, is guilt the word, about passing some of this on to your own daughters?
Yes, I did.
And they believe in hell right now, or are they going through a journey as well?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't actually have a talk with any of them as of right now. They may or they may not. However, I would like to, you know, to play safe, I would like to think that they do fear hell.
Did you teach them to fear hell?
No.
Did you tell them about hell?
No, not at all. Even
okay,
as a
so where do they get it from, if not from you?
Preachers. Probably preachers.
Okay. May I ask how old your kids are?
Well, the ones that I'm telling right now, one is 17 and the other one is 15.
And you have not been involved in sort of the informing of their religious faith or lack of? You just take them to church and the pastors do the teaching?
Well, not exactly. Not exactly. We do have some reading here, some studies here and there. I did some of that. However, to the best of my knowledge, I don't recall it ever giving any kind of study or even mention it is here, because it was uncomfortable for me, even as a Christian.
Yeah. So the guilt that you carry comes from where? I mean, you didn't tell them to fear hell. Is it for involving them in a church that has hell theology?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
I know I can do better.
And
pretty much.
Well, if I may, and I don't want to overstep here, but, you know, they're not 8 years old.
No.
They are at a point where, you know, they're involved in the world, and they're not stupid, and they see you, and they know you. This sounds like a great conversation to have. You know, let's go have dinner. And rather than talking about them and what they think, I mean, you can ask them questions and really pick their brains. But to speak more about your own journey, I have a feeling they'd be hugely compelled by that kind of exchange. They'd be fascinated by it. I mean, it might rattle their cages a little bit. But, you know, it's not like you're talking to a pre-junior high school kid who would just go into tilt mode. You're talking to, you know, 14 and a 17-year-old, and you're speaking honestly about your own journey and your own questions and doubts, and then you could then encourage them to take a journey on their own terms, could you not?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I started, but not with them, but with my wife. And this is where the fun begins. She's still holding on firmly, and she's still pretty devoted. I only addressed this issue with her once, and suddenly all hell breaks loose. Why are you doing this? Why are you denying your faith? Why you don't believe anymore? You used to be a teacher, or, you know, all the rhetoric that comes along with it. I was like, hey, I'm asking a sincere question.
All right. You spoke to your wife. How did you present it to her? What'd you say?
I asked her the question, do you believe that my job was given by God, or did I have to do something with it? Obviously given by God. Why are you even asking this? And I was like, you know what? I busted my butt in college, and I went to the military, and my experience goes in that resume, and God wasn't doing the exam for me, you know? So it was God, yeah. How can he tell?
Okay.
That's it. That's all I said. And how can he tell? If it was God or if it wasn't, how can he tell? Where do we draw the line? And it started there by asking a simple question.
All right. Now there's a point of contention between you. She realizes that you're having some doubts, some real doubts.
Well, to her credit, our marriage is very, very, it's a strong marriage. We know how to talk. We know how to negotiate. It has always been like that so far. So far.
Even with religion, even with her cherished faith, you're
still
good.
We're going to put that to the test right now, because I just recently came to this. Can I call it the conversion? Can I call it the conversion?
The conversion works for me.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you have a better word, I'll be happy to hear it. I don't know of any other.
Look, I mean, I don't care. Whatever, call it whatever you want. Here's some unsolicited advice when talking to your wife.
Go for it.
My advice to you is this. Don't try to convince her. it's going to eat away at you, and she's going to say something that there's a logical fallacy or this is wrong or blah, blah, blah. I mean, you can have those discussions at a certain point, but when you're having a conversation about your own journey, your goal is not to convince her, because you're not going to do it in those moments. You need to be relating your own journey. I went through this. I've examined that. I have a hard time with this. I don't believe that. I no longer hold to this. You use the word I a lot. This keeps her off the defensive, and you're not telling her this is what you should think. This is why I think you're wrong, because she's going to put the walls up, and it's really going to be difficult to have any kind of conversation when you're talking to her and even with your daughters. Talk about yourself. This is kind of where I'm at, and here is how I got there, and here's what I'm thinking, and I just wanted to be honest with you. And that's one of the best ways to approach it. And if you aren't trying to convince them and win in those moments, I think you're going to save yourself lots of grief in the long run. There will be concern. There may be tears. There could be raised voices. There might be prayers on your behalf. But at the end of the day, they don't feel like you came after them. And then they'll be watching you and your journey with a lot of curiosity. And when they see that you're still the same good guy that you always were, and you still work hard, and you still love them, and you still have joy and purpose and amazing stuff, but you did so on your own terms without all this religion stuff, there might be a part of them that responds to that, and then they'll come to you, and perhaps they will engage and then open up to the doubts they might have in their own mind and heart. That makes sense?
Perfect sense.
Okay. In the meantime, my friend, I mean, I know we've spoken for quite a long time here. At the end of the day, I honestly think that it took me a year and a half to get over my fears of being wrong. I was hosting the Thinking Atheist website for 18 months, and I was on the radio for 6 months, roughly. And deep under the skin, under the surface, I still was up at night thinking, what if I'm wrong? I don't want to burn forever. And my escape came through the studies of what hell is and how hell has been used. The morality of hell, the idea that a benevolent and loving deity would ever torture any living thing, you know, that helped quite a bit. To get into the sort of the logistics of hell, what's being burned? Is it my spirit? Well, that doesn't make any sense, because you can't burn a spirit. So my physical body's there. Well, what happens when it burns to ash? Am I then regenerated and then he burns me again? And that makes even less sense physically and morally. Is hell just annihilation? Is it the grave? Is it mere separation? Am I floating in the abyss? And the more you see all of these sort of conflicting, weird, wild notions of hell, the more it all starts to splinter and fall away, and then we can more and more root ourselves in the real world. I'd hate the idea of you living your life in fear, because that's what religions want. They want us to be afraid. They want to tell us these things are sacred and beyond challenge, and we shouldn't ever, 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 ever distance ourselves or criticize them. And I think there's a tremendous liberation in being able to say, I am no longer afraid. And Gregory, in your life, wherever your journey takes you, whatever you end up calling yourself, if anything, it doesn't have to be atheist, doesn't have to be agnostic, doubter, seeker. I don't give a shit. Whatever. I want you to be living a liberated life, an honestly approached life on your terms. And I think many in the audience would agree with me. Okay?
Very understandable.
Has any of this helped at all?
It has helped a great deal, because in here, since I, you know, this is pretty much the environment that I live with, it's really hard to raise your hand and say, hey, I have this question. I mean, not challenge anything. Just say, hey, I have this question. And suddenly every cannon is pointing towards you, because you have a question. And having a question with no answer leads to another question, and then another one, and another one.
Would you hang on, Gregory? You mentioned earlier that not knowing bothers you, and I'm glad you came back to that, because it had slipped my mind. I want you to see the answer, I don't know, differently, right? Where we are uncomfortable with uncertainty. If someone says, where did the Big Bang, what started the singularity? How did the universe come into motion? And we're uncomfortable saying, I don't know.
Well, I don't know doesn't bother me at all. There's one thing that bothers me more.
What?
I can deal with I don't know. The thing is that in Christianity, you barely get that. you barely get the I don't know. You always get, well, if you didn't know, God did it. He got out of the gaps.
Yeah, yeah, I get that. The Lord works in mysterious ways. We take it on faith. But you had mentioned that uncertainty was a problem for you. I mean, the not knowing, is you're okay with that?
Yeah, not having, let's say, knowledge in X, Y, or Z. But when I said not knowing, and I thank you for reminding me, when I say not knowing, I do mean uncertainty on what happens, for example, after we die. Is there really a soul? Is there really a God? I mean, not Jehovah, any God. Is there any God at all? Is there a supreme being? Is there something out there? I mean, those questions, that's what I mean by not knowing. And probably I may never know the answer to those. But that's the uncertainty that I was mentioning.
Let's start here. Let's try to make a pact with each other. You know, we'll never know everything. It's just that it's just the nature of our existence. There's so much out there that we will never know. But let us make the pledge to each other to try to know more tomorrow than we know today.
Totally agree. Indeed, yeah.
Right? I can live with that if you can. Like, we'll never, look, it's a big mystery after you die. There's no evidence for a heaven, but blah, blah, blah. And people can bring all kinds of claims to us. These, by the way, I consider scientific questions. So we still go out and hypothesize and experiment and test and retest. I mean, all of these are scientific questions. But even though we'll never know everything, let's you and I, Gregory, try our best to know more tomorrow than we did today. That sounds to me like a life worth living. Okay?
Oh, it sounds like purpose to me.
Gregory, it's been an honor to speak with you, my friend. Of course, you have my email address, and I hope this conversation has benefited some other people within the listening audience. Perhaps they might forward it on to some other folks who are on a similar journey as yours. In the meantime, you hug the girls, and all my best to you and your family.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thank you for your time, sir. Really appreciate it. Hey, by the way, bless you, man.
I love you with the love of the Lord. Yeah.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.